There's something happening here. But what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I've got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Welcome home to Passionate Justice 73. Thank all of you. I do thank all of you for your continuing and growing support. I'm so pleased more and more of you are following the show on Twitter. For all Passionate Justice news, podcasts, releases, I ask all of you, follow the show at JWOLF41387, at JWOLF41387 on Twitter. Now a new hour, personal notes, great guest writers spurring you on every week, every day, a new chance to create a little more justice in our world, and I want you to join our salon. It's the very best readers and writers site on the internet, and it's growing, and it's hosted by the wonderful Lori Wright, and it's free. You can join right now at www.oursalon.ning.com. www.oursalon.ning.com. I am author activist Jonathan Wolfman, the spark for these stories. Passionate Justice, a progressive memoir in essays. It's available at Amazon. Yes, Amazon. And I am so proud to say, underwriting for Passionate Justice in 2015 comes from Bud Clayman and OC87 Productions, producers of OC87 RecoveryDiaries.com and the feature-length film OC87, The Obsessive Compulsive Major Depression Bipolar Asperger's Movie. Right now, you go check out OC87 RecoveryDiaries.com. Straight away, I remind you, our very important program is coming up. And I have a request. And this request could put you, that's right, it could put you on the radio. You know, if you've got a brain, you know that politicians worship our veterans until the moment those politicians get elected, and then most Pauls are pleased to forget veterans' real long-term needs until they, when, well, until the Pauls run for re-election. But we at Starcom note that we're in the run-up to the 40th anniversary of the fall of Saigon, and you see, it doesn't matter where you stood as to the wisdom of that war. You all know how I feel about that. But if you're honest, you're going to agree that the Viet War vets have been treated shabbily. Starcom cannot make up for government neglect, administration after administration, but we will do this. We will do this. On April 30, our morning show, Upfront and Outspoken, with Bob Williams, will be doing a very special tribute to all our men and women who served in Southeast Asia, and yeah, you can be a part. If you've a personal experience you want to share, and I hope you do, for this tribute, I want you to email Bob Williams at kkrp1610@yahoo.com, kkrp1610@yahoo.com, and in the subject line, just write VET, VET. And again, we want to share your Vietnam story. Send them to KKRP 1610 at yahoo.com. Thank you so much. Now, here's a question for you. When you're at a restaurant, you appreciate good food, well-made, in a clean environment, yeah? Well, you recall that Seinfeld episode where Jerry's date, the daughter of Poppy, the restaurateur, witnesses Poppy himself, the owner of the restaurant, leaving his own restaurant's bathroom stall. He bypasses the sinks, proceeds to prepare Jerry's dinner, and of course Jerry will neither eat what's served nor tell Poppy's daughter why he won't touch her dad's food. Well, lucky you. You could be Jerry if North Carolina Tea Party Senator Tom Tillis has his way. Why? Because Senator Tillis thinks your freedom's more important than your health, and my health, and your kids' health. Jen Hayden in the Daily Kos asks, do you think restaurants should be able to opt out? Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina is not so sure why we need laws requiring food service employees to wash their hands. Tillis told the Bipartisan Policy Council that he has, quote, a bias when it comes to regulatory reform. Tillis said, I was having a discussion with someone at a Starbucks in my district. That's again in North Carolina. And we were talking about certain regulations where I felt like, well, maybe you should allow businesses to opt out. Or whatever. Restaurants can just opt out and let the free market take care of business and your gut. After word spreads of unsanitary conditions, you see, the market will just take care of itself. Never mind that a lack of hand washing by food service employees accounts for the vast majority of food contamination. See, spreading germs from the hands of food workers to food is an important cause of foodborne illnesses, outbreaks, accounting for, you guess. Well, in fact, it's 89% of outbreaks in which food was contaminated. Proper hand washing can reduce germs on workers' hands and the spread of germs from hands to food and from food to other people. Making sure businesses are free to operate under any conditions they'd like is apparently, for Senator Tillis and those in the Tea Party, more important than public health and safety. He says, that's the sort of mentality that we need to have to reduce the regulatory burden on the businesses of this country. We're one of the most regulated nations in the history of the planet. Well, no word on where Senator Tillis stands on seatbelts, surgeons having to go to med school before they take out your appendix. Commercial airplane pilots needing licenses. We certainly know about commercial airplane pilots, don't we? Or police having to certify at the shooting range. Oh, why bother? After all, food businesses could save so much money and pass the savings on to you, along with any number of dreadful diseases, if we just got rid of the burdensome no-serving-food-from-dumpsters regs. So, speaking of freedom, safety, and the Lord, Mississippi, its House of Representatives, just passed the Jesus Take the Wheel Act. The what? That's right, the Jesus Take the Wheel Act. Thank God for Mississippi. Its lawmakers are once again tackling the big issues in the state. Highest poverty rate in the nation, taking that one on? Nope. Second highest high school dropout rate in the country, addressing that? Nah. second highest teen pregnancy rate in the country. Are they addressing that one? Hell no. What's more pressing than extreme poverty, teen pregnancy, and poor education? You foolish, foolish, foolish fools. It's the Jesus Takes the Wheel Act. The Mississippi House just passed a bill, House Bill 132, nicknamed the Jesus Take the Wheel Act. And what would it do? What would it do? It would exempt churches from commercial driver's license requirements. Those CDLs, those annoying CDLs. This allows small churches, some don't have people with commercial licenses at all, and they can pick a person to drive the bus, said the chair of the Mississippi House Transportation Committee. See, current Mississippi law requires CDL-certified drivers for any vehicle transporting more than 16 passengers, including the driver. This bill would amend that law to exempt church buses designed to carry 30 passengers or less, since the exemption, you see, would also include buses and large transport vehicles carrying children to and from events. Not everyone is happy, you see, about the exemption. When contacted by the Clarion Ledger newspaper, longtime CDL-certified driver Troy Call of Hattiesburg, Mississippi, called the measure potentially dangerous. You think? He said it's trading the safety of everyone on the road for the convenience of those operating church vehicles, Mr. Call said. Since the bill covers vehicles up to 30 passengers, we're not just talking vans with extra rows of seats. These are buses with long frames, much larger blind spots than passenger vehicles. So, people, let me ask you. You gotta know some Jesus-driven church bus is gonna crash and kids gonna die. Reminds me of the old blues man, Mississippi Slim's number. Everybody wanna get to heaven, nobody wanna die. Everybody wanna get to heaven, nobody wanna die. So when, not if, one of these, two of these, three of these blessed buses, rams an RV, five kids die, slams into a Sunday church picnic, five kids die, plunges off the Tallahatchie Bridge and Billy Joe McAllister and five other new teen moms and their bundled babies die. What the hell did Mississippi kids ever do to deserve legislatures this idiotic? And when they die, when these kids die, that legislature will console the families with what? With what? The devil did it? It's the Lord's will? Jesus was asleep at the wheel? Now, we're really going to switch it up, and I want to ask you a very serious question, because we've all been in this situation without even knowing it. So here's the question to lead into a very important topic. How do you spot a sex trafficking victim, say, at an airport? Let me ask that one again. How do you spot a sex trafficking victim at an airport? You know, sex trafficking's huge business in the United States. And if that's so, and it is, how come more people don't notice it? You ever wonder about that? How come more people don't notice? Every time a new horror story about sex trafficking pops up, about women held for years against their will, girls forced to be child brides, boys and girls and women and sometimes men, yes, sometimes men, snatched up and ensnared in prostitution rings, the same question always comes up. It always crops up. Why didn't anybody notice anything? One of the reasons, you see, that sex trafficking is frequently overlooked is because it's hiding in plain sight. It is. Sex trafficking's hiding in plain sight. Victims are not always bundled across borders in cars, vans with blacked-out windows, or transported in shipping containers. Sometimes they're simply brought in with thousands of other international travelers on an airplane, or just intra-country travelers, and forced into sex at local hotels. As we've highlighted just last year on Passionate Justice, you see, law enforcement's now beginning to work with businesses, particularly hotels and airlines, to spot people who are being moved around against their wills. Delta employees are now being trained. Delta is now training its employees, and this is a good thing, to ask certain questions at check-in. Letty Ashworth, she's the general manager of global diversity for Delta, told a packed summit on human trafficking in New York this past September, and she told them how to carefully watch for anyone whose documents, for example, are not in their own physical possession, their travel documents. If you're at a gate, she says, and there's an unaccompanied minor, do they know the name of the person they're traveling with or where they're going? If they don't, well, figure it out. Crew members also watch now for unusual activity on a plane, such as when kids don't and won't answer questions or avoid eye contact when addressed. Other signs might be bruising or other wounds or a ravenous appetite. And don't expect trafficking victims to be foreign. See, that's really important. Don't expect trafficking victims to be foreign necessarily. You want to guess how many are Americans? Listen to this. 83% of people forced into prostitution in the U.S. are from the U.S. One more time. 83% of folks forced into prostitution in the U.S. are from here. They're often runaways and sometimes have been at the mercy of their traffickers for so long. They see themselves not as women being pimped out for sex, but as girlfriends helping their boyfriend pay the bills. We've had women testify on behalf of their abuser that they loved him and were not there against their will, even though they'd been severely abused, says Manhattan DA Cyrus Vance. He has seen women, that is, the Manhattan DA, Mr. Vance, he has seen women tattooed with a barcode as a mark of a pimp's ownership. I want to say that one again. The Manhattan DA has seen women tattooed with barcodes as marks of ownership. Vance's office is also working with hotels to prosecute sex traffic offenders. And one of the big red flags, one of the big ones, is people who have had a pattern of frequently booking a series of hotel rooms on a credit card and then paying in cash only. That's a reason why hotel chains must be involved in this. And because sex trafficking spikes when around the Super Bowl, of course, hotel employees too are now being asked to be particularly vigilant during that time of year, end of January, beginning of February, and the NFL has been asked to only host the Super Bowl in states that have robust anti-trafficking laws. The response to that trafficking activists are hoping for, our response that they're hoping for, is similar to the response that our government and other governments want for potential terrorism. If you see something, say something. If you see something, say something. D.A. Vance says, first people have to decide what they care about. Unless you acknowledge that it happens and are prepared to talk about it, it's not going to change. It all starts at the grassroots. We had 3,500 homeless kids come to New York last year. 3,500 last year alone. They're a target for these sex traffickers. It has to start from people understanding that these aren't kids in Africa, Asia, South America. These are largely our kids. Do you think we can make a dent in sex trafficking? Your first step, friends, your first step should be to try just a little harder to see what's in front of you at bus and rail stations, at airports, and call. Make the call when you see a kid who may well be in trouble. Could you be wrong? Yeah, of course you could be wrong. But what if you're right? Now, here's a piece I wrote some time back, and it's still an issue, and it deals with trafficking, but of a different sort. It's about the National Rifle Association's not wanting to deny weapons to whom? That's right, the NRA does not want us, our own country, to deny weapons to those who are on terrorist lists. Say that one again. The NRA is not interested in our government denying weapons to those on terrorist lists, on those watch lists. Now, you may have thought, for example, that the NRA leadership's response to the December 2012 murders of Connecticut school children, you may have thought their response was inadequate. You may even have deemed their response mad or even rapacious. I do. However, the organization's sense of that high-powered mayhem may well be nowhere close to the lunacy of its stand on the issue of weapons in the hands of potential terrorists, people already on our watch lists. You see, the NRA has long stood against legislation that had originally been introduced by the late Democratic Senator Frank Lautenberg of New Jersey and New York's Republican Congressman and Homeland Security Committee Chair Pete King. You see, their proposal would close a ridiculous and perhaps lethal gap in existing federal law about who may and who may not buy or own firearms. Right now, people on terrorist watch lists may buy and own weapons. Let that sink in, because I'm going to say it again. Right now, people on terrorist watch lists may buy and own weapons. The bill to end that has gone where in Congress? Oh, that's right, nowhere. For many years, felons, convicted domestic abusers, as well as the certified deranged, haven't been able legally to purchase their own guns. I think I'm knowing who else is deranged. But you see, the Lautenberg-King bill would close the terrorist list gap, and it would close it tight. The Nonpartisan Government Accountability Office, which is called the GAO, it says that people on our own terror watch lists, and this spans the Bush and Obama administrations between 04 and 13, succeeded in purchasing firearms, people already on the list, 865 times in how many attempts? 865 times in 963 attempts. And those who failed largely because they were already on no-buy lists for other reasons. Now, while I've written before that I'm not against gun ownership per se, I am not. My son, as I've told you, is a championship marksman, and I avidly support his effort. But I'm not a born-yesterday fool either. You know, the castration anxiety and the base greed that compels the NRA to oppose clear-as-a-bell sensitive anti-terror and other reasonable legislation, it should be called out for what it is. What is it? It's the flailing of dangerous weapons industry-enabled psychopathology. And we'll be right back. Welcome back to the second half of Passionate Justice 73. And do, follow the show on Twitter at JWOLF41387, at JWOLF41387. 41387 on Twitter. And, yeah, join the very best writers and readers site on the net, Our Salon, at www.oursalon.ning.com, www.oursalon.ning.com. Now, here is really out of box for you. New to Passionate Justice is writer Moki Ikam from the Pacific Island Vanuatu. Well, where is Vanuatu? It's in Oceania, northeast of Australia, just west of Fiji, south of the Solomon Islands, Tonga and Tuvalu, and west of Tahiti. The islands we call Vanuatu have been home to Melanesian peoples for over 2,500 years. Now, what does Vanuatu mean? It means our land forever in the Melanesian language. And in the 15th century, European explorers and missionaries began arriving, and the islands did change. When Captain James Cook sailed through the chain in 1774, just prior to the signing of our Declaration of Independence, he chartered and named many of the islands and collectively named them New Hebrides, after the islands off the west coast of Scotland. They were administered jointly by Britain and France for many years, and national pride finally took hold, forcing independence at the late date of 1980, and they gave it a new name, Vanuatu. No longer New Hebrides, but now Vanuatu, and gave it a new constitution. Now, those islands, Vanuatu, it's famed for gorgeous land and attractive volcano activity and a very intact Melanesian culture, especially on Tanna Island. And it includes 13 larger islands and about 70 rather small ones, and most are mountainous, needless to say, volcanic in origin, and some are active. They continue to be active today, and they're covered in lush rainforest, and many of them are protected by coral reefs. The islands are subject to devastating cyclones, what we call hurricanes here, and the most destructive one in 87 damaged or ruined most of the local dwellings, and while most of the outer islands maintain their traditional Melanesian lifestyle, the impressive city of Port Vila is crammed with colonial buildings, expatriates, duty-free shops, casinos, open-air markets, upscale restaurants, and tourists. Vanuatu has about 210,000 people. Its capital, as I say, is Port Vila, and it has about 40,000. So with that background, I take you to Vanuatu, and I ask you, ever wonder if humans consume and populate so much that Earth will one day find us unwelcome? Here's Moki's poetic take. He calls this whirling thrill ride to oblivion. I see my children caught, as we all are, in our Euro-American spiral toward oblivious doom, our incessant fascination with warfare, material predations on a planet where life supported humanity's selfishness, greed, fateful abuses, seemingly infinitely forgiving of us, until our nuclear age-driven exhaustion of our planet's carbon banks, until us, Earth seemed to defy a law of our understanding of the universe, all is proceeding to greater entropy, greater chaos. The amalgam of elements that make up the surface, with its deposits of relatively pure elements on this droplet of mass circling a star our feet call Earth, indicate this droplet of matter's surface crystallized, settled out, cooled, skinned, over according to densities, melting and boiling points, water solubilities, DNA evolutions, random unions with asteroids and the like, an overall process that is not chaos, not disorder, but the opposite. Then along comes us. Our exploitations of ore, precious metal, carbon, DNA, water, our exploitation of that which laws of nature have ordered, our industrialized rendering toward maximum entropy, that which had before us existed, exists in contradiction to being a result of a natural process proceeding toward maximum chaos. Our nature as humans has been to self-fulfill our prophecy of everything proceeding to maximum chaos. However, millions of tears, years from now, carbon-based life on Earth will have greatly benefited from humans having recycled so much carbon from past life on Earth back into the atmosphere. See, as I thank Moki Ikam for this, I ask what a reader asked. Growth as the be-all, growth as the end-all of economic development, how does that make any sense on a finite planet? Over the course of geologic time, Earth will cleanse itself of us, just as it has cleansed itself in the past of every other species run amok. Really, who believes that we will actually keep sufficient carbon in the ground to survive? Fair questions, people. Have we the sense to develop sustainable answers? So, speaking of survival, here's our friend, church choir member Terry McKenna of Dover, New Jersey, who last year spoke about the question, who gets to speak for Christianity? But today, Terry McKenna speaks directly to the mess in the Near East. And Terry touches on a theme we raised here last week as we witnessed the Muslim Near East descend into the chaotic, uncontrolled violence. That chaotic, uncontrolled violence. We need recall this is what happened in Christian Europe 500 years ago between Catholics and Protestants. Terry calls this piece Time for War. Yes, it's time for folks in the Middle East to kill each other. We need to stay out of this. Wars as old as man happens for a variety of reasons, can be as small as tribal skirmishes amongst Stone Age warriors. When really big wars erupt, it's a sign that the old power structures no longer work. Sadly, the old powers don't tend to recognize they must leave the table, so they fight. And in the end, are obliterated. War is not new. The Roman Empire emerged as the controlling power in the Mediterranean more than 2,000 years ago. For two centuries, it managed to create a peace of sorts. But eventually, the restless Germanic peoples of Central Europe wanted in, and later on, the Asiatic Huns. The result was a long and messy collapse over several centuries, leaving an empty space that was eventually filled with smaller European ethnic-based states. More than a millennium after the collapse of Rome, the Catholic unity of Europe burst apart, and so did the remains of the Holy Roman Empire in a war that raged 30 years in Central Europe. The war may have been partly about religion, as the emerging Protestants wanted to be free of the yoke of the Catholic Church at Rome, but in the end, the war was also a time to settle grievances of all sorts. At one point in the struggle, the various interventions by one party or another may have made sense, but in the end, it was pouring gasoline on embers, and many starved marching of troops often took place over a field of grain and once trampled no harvest. Wars always seem reasonable at the start, almost always get out of hand. Even well-meaning efforts like ours in the Balkans also helped foster the enmity of Russia, ultimately tipped against the Serbs, and the Russians have always felt the Serbs were theirs to protect. So now we see the Middle East bursting apart, bursting open, and if history's any predictor, it will not end well. As with Europe of those centuries, we've religious splits, in this case, Shia and Sunni Muslims, and we've ethnic tensions between Arabs and Persian Iran. These tensions are the consequence of the collapse of the Ottoman Empire and the misguided distribution of land after the Paris Peace Conference of 1919. After the first war, Israel too remains a bone of contention created in 1948. It, too, is tied to the 1919 Paris Peace Conference, which recognized the right of Jews to a homeland perceived in someone else's backyard and then encouraged Jewish immigration there. The damage is done and Israel's not going away, but the situation adds to the tension. The conflict was inevitable, but was made more so by the Second Iraq War, with our reckless dismantling of the Iraqi army and installation of what was, in essence, a Shia government. It may be true that no good deed goes unpunished. The fate of misdeeds is even more fraught. So here we are. Here we are. The Saudis are engaged. So are we. So are the Jordanians and a host of ethnic militias, terror groups, the main fightings going on in Syria, Iran, Libya, and Yemen, but Afghanistan, Pakistan, they're in play, as is Iran. Our warhawks want us to do something, just do something, and fools such as UN Representative, former UN Representative John Bolton suggests bombing Iran, but military interventions, they don't ultimately work. This has to play out until people in the region feel that war is the very last thing they ever want to do. It will take a lot of dying before that happens. I hope very few Americans will be among the corpses. And Terry adds this, you've heard the right-wing talking point that goes, our friends no longer trust us, our enemies don't fear us, the claims Obama's lack of a specific policy is the problem, rather than our effort to tip the Middle East one way or another. Of course, that's absurd. Our pre-Obama Middle East policies failed so utterly that now what we need right now is no fixed, let alone a rigid policy. We need time. If we look to history, we should know that Vietnam was created out of policy, the domino theory, and the desire to counter communism may have made some little sense at the time, but after Vietnam, we laid low. Southeast Asia was the better for it. Vietnam now sees us as an ally, a bulwark against its traditional predator, China. And our friends, the feckless Egyptians, ruled by a military that will never give up real power, and by the Saud family, the Saudis who have spent their money funding radical Islam. We had a hand in creating the current mess, but we also showed how we can't clean it. Perhaps best we sit back. Experts abound. For example, General Jack Keane, retired, who presents himself as an expert. He spreads his pomposity on Fox. No, he's no expert. Yes, he knows how to run a battle. He knows just how many bullets to bring to battle, and that's about it. A real expert has done something often enough and succeeded often enough that he or she knows the issue or process pretty cold. I'm an expert in certain life insurance matters, and outside the office I'm an expert bike rider and an expert at cutting wood, whether by hand, by handheld power, say, or by a table saw. I've cut wood from oak and maple to cedar to pine. Pine's easier. So no, General Keane's not an expert, nor does he know much about the Middle East beyond where the various states are on a map. Nor is Petraeus, General Petraeus, an expert. Yeah, he knows about the mechanics of battling an insurgency, but that's it. He's not battled many of them, nor have we ultimately succeeded where he spent time. Not his fault. But he's no expert on what will work now in the Near East. Nor are any of those neocons, nor is John McCain an expert. An aging, reckless jock went down 5 times over Vietnam before they caught him. Would have been dismissed from flying had he not been an admiral's son. Nor are the 47 senators experts who sent that letter to Iran. And as I thank Terry McKenna for this, I'll add that we need to recall what writer Ed Simon said here of the European Christian religious wars. Liberal attitudes were birthed. And grew as a result of a people so weary of war, so weary of blood-soaked sod for hundreds of years, and people realizing that their only hope was to live even grudgingly with and near one another. Blood-soaked sod? Sand, sadly, absorbs far more blood. Now, our friend Claire Connor, author of the astonishing, wonderful book Wrapped in the Flag, and you will want to get it, about growing up in one of the founding families of the Radical Rights John Birch Society before, as a teen, leaving her family. Claire last shared here on corporate personhood her consistent contention, and she is spot on, is that the Tea Party takeover of the Republican Party represents the John Bircher's greatest triumph. Here, Claire talks about those good old days when poverty was healthy and Americans were free. People tell me that the John Birch Society ideas are dead. They tell me that the Birch Society has no real influence today. I completely disagree. The radical right, which is running the House of Representatives and half the Senate, has embraced so many John Birch policies I can hardly keep count. Let's take a look at a few important examples of Birch ideas in today's Republican Party: slashing food stamps, eliminating the social safety net, gutting unemployment compensation. These moves are right in line with the views of Robert Welch, founder of the John Birch Society. Welch praised the turn of the 20th century, the 1900s, as the golden age of the United States. He was delighted that in those years the U.S. had not been poisoned by the abominations of the New Deal. Business could do as it pleased without those pesky labor unions or minimum wage laws. Few had heard of pollution, women's rights, civil rights at the turn of the 19th to the 20th centuries, and best of all, the government was tiny. No one paid an income tax. Listen to Welch's description. Listen to his description of the first decade of the 1900s. Quote, "The spirit of growth, of adventure, and of opportunity permeated the very atmosphere which everybody breathed. There was still plenty of poverty in many areas, of course, but it was a healthy kind of poverty, where every man took for granted that relief from dire want was entirely his own problem and responsibility, and even the poverty was thus offset by the enormous blessing of freedom." Robert Welch called Social Security a gigantic embezzlement. His words are echoed today by such anti-Social Security men as Charles and David Koch, Rick Perry, GOP Governor of Texas, Ron Paul, Libertarian Darling, and former GOP Congressman from Texas. A whole gang of Republicans dream of privatizing Social Security, thrilling bankers, leaving Americans at the whim of Wall Street. The majority of the GOP now parrots Robert Welch and the John Birch Society. In 1964, Welch wrote about the necessities of life, quote, "While food, shelter, and clothing are necessities for an individual in a civilized community, the guarantee that he will always have them is not necessary for living in a civilized community." Pay attention to the drumbeat. Pay attention to the drumbeat against food stamps and unemployment compensation. You'll hear Robert Welch in a new suit, Paul Ryan, Steve Stockman, Tim Huelskamp, Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, Mitch McConnell. Of course these men will never need food stamps, never need unemployment compensation. They are prosperous, as are most of our politicians. Today's GOPers are hell-bent on returning us to a time when healthy poverty, was everywhere and the government had no authority to do anything about it. The rich ruled, everyone else scratched for whatever they could. This new breed of Republicans is as radical as the John Birch Society and even more dangerous. This time around, they've media support, corporate money, lots of it. And Claire points to an old sepia 1911 photo. I want you to picture this in your minds, people. Claire points to an old sepia 1911 photo of filthy-faced, dispirited, hopeless Pennsylvania child coal mine workers. Claire says, "Child coal mine workers, remember this photo." I want you to see them in your minds, folks. When today's radical right-wingers insist that we don't need unions, the minimum wage, OSHA, health care, or any other socialism, according to the radical right, we all need just liberty, and that's it, freedom from government's patriotism. Wave your flags, boys, and as we thank Claire, please remember those kids in your mind and ask yourselves, is that what you want? That what you want for your country? Think it couldn't happen again? No? Really? Presidential candidate Newt Gingrich in 2012 out loud, again and again, said we need to return to those times for children, and no Republican called him on it. None. And now perhaps the dumbest small business decision ever. Armando Flavio in Anonymous reports a Chinese restaurant has banned blacks in Kenya. In its capital, Nairobi, a Chinese restaurant does not admit Africans on the idea that they are a security threat. According to the Nairobi News last year, there was a robbery incident at the restaurant, and the Chinese owners of the restaurant thereafter made the decision to stop Africans from eating there. And Ms. Esther Zhao, the spokeswoman for the restaurant, wait a second, how many restaurants actually need spokespersons? Well, she said that the blacks' ban was in response to incidents related to Somalia's militant group Al-Shabaab in the Kenyan capital. "We don't admit Africans because you never know. It's not like it's written on someone's face that they're a thug armed with a gun." Ms. Zhao also offered this: "Guests feel safer and more comfortable if Africans are kept away." People, this is in Africa. Exceptions? Oh, yes, there are exceptions. Only taxi drivers and Africans accompanied by European, Chinese, or Indian guests can be admitted. And it will not surprise Passionate Justice listeners when you learn that in the restaurant, blacks do the menial work. See, while Kenya has anti-discrimination laws, I'd be pleased were the restaurant to succumb to its own inane business model. Now, wrapping today, here's a question. Are you concerned real law, that is, Islamic law, is being legislated here in the U.S.? Well, you've heard that, I know you have, that Sharia law is being legislated right here in the United States. Well, if you like Sharia law, you're in luck. Why? Well, here are some characteristics of Sharia law. You figure it out. Women's health decisions under law, under Sharia law, largely in men's hands. Women's roles in public life under Sharia law are limited by religious doctrine. Government basic law based on, reflective of, that's right, religious doctrine. And with Sharia law, there's little or no distinction between religious and civil law. And men enjoy, here's a surprise, more rights under law than do women. And, of course, under Sharia law, homosexuality is criminalized. And under Sharia law, religious doctrine takes precedence over scientific method and discovery, and religion is taught in schools, and it influences the general studies curriculum. Are you concerned? Are you concerned? Vote out. Deny election to those here of any religion, promoting these positions. They're not inspired by the challenges of the 7th century when Sharia law came about, let alone by those of the 21st, nor are they inspired by justice. I know what is inspired by justice. You are. You are inspired by justice. I want you to follow this program on Twitter at jwolf41387 and keep trying to live as if justice matters. What your kids and you do matter. Be creative, courageous. Take your place on that great Mandela. Take your place next to all the wonderful writers who have been on this show today and right next to me. Because this is our brief moment of time. Phil Oak said, I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. You know he was right. You can repair this crazy place, and I promise when you act on justice's behalf, it does pay back, and it will most definitely make you happy. For our 74th at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on the Starcom Radio and Satellite Network, and right now, on Twitter, follow JWolf41387, because there and everywhere, it's passionate justice.
We gotta get out of this place. If it's the last thing we ever do, we gotta get out of this place. Girl, there's a better life for me and you. Believe me, baby, I know it, baby. You know it too, baby.